Thanks for listening to the American Heritage Podcast. My guest today is Aaron Hale. Aaron Hale is probably the most inspiring man I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. He was an executive chef in the Navy, where he cooked for many three-star admirals. He sailed around the Mediterranean, visiting all the places that a lot of us can only dream about going. But Aaron felt the need to do more, so he left the Navy and eventually joined the Army, where he became an EOD technician. One day, while serving in Afghanistan, dismantling roadside bombs and keeping soldiers safe, a second IED went off and Aaron lost his eyesight. He was now 100% blind, and after about 30 surgeries, he became deaf by a contracted case of meningitis. Aaron never let that slow him down one bit. He went on to run many marathons without the ability to see. He does a lot of backpacking and hiking. He does kayaking. He does whitewater rafting. And on top of that, he runs his own company where he makes awesome fudge and ships it all over the world. It's called EOD Fudge, and you can visit his website at www.eodfudge.com. Without further ado, here's Aaron. I saw your bio and I was like, okay, I gotta talk to this guy, whatever we got to do to make it happen. So I was glad to hear that your cochlear implant has Bluetooth, which I didn't know that was even possible. So that's awesome.
Oh yeah. I'm halfway to becoming Borg. it's incredible. The technology today is amazing. Even between like 5-10 years ago and today, if this were, let's say, 20 years ago, I would be pulling the full Helen Keller, and life would be far more difficult.
Yeah, I can only imagine how difficult that would have been. So if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to just hear your story from, you know, the very beginning. So where did you grow up at?
Well, I grew up in Akron, Ohio. I grew up in Akron, Ohio, and it was, you know, the Midwestern, literally a lot of the places I associate my childhood with look like right out of a Norman Rockwell painting. I really had a terrific childhood. Sometimes when speaking with other military members and where they came from, it's pretty vanilla, but I loved it. I played, you know, football and went to, you know, community gatherings and stuff like that. And I really had a terrific and great community with my upbringing.
So what made you decide to join the military?
It's funny. I absolutely knew my entire life until about a month before joining the military, I'd never be in the military. I just wasn't, I was a patriot as though I loved the 4th of July, and I really appreciated being in America. I knew it was the greatest country in the world, but I never had any ambition to be in the service. The truth is I didn't really have much ambition for anything. No direction, no goals. I went to college thinking, I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't have a track. I didn't have a plan. And instead, I kind of lapsed into more of the animal house mentality, which within 3 freshman semesters, I had gained something like 50 pounds and I was just burning tuition money. So it was kind of a mutual thing. The college didn't really want me and I didn't want to be there. So I left school and I moved out to California where my dad lives, and I got a couple jobs, one, you know, during the day working at a surf shop and in the evening in a restaurant. And I lost that freshman 50, but I'd already burned the tuition away and I was thinking, okay, I need to get myself together. I need to find those goals. And I need to have some direction. I want to go back to school and do it the right way. And the military was the answer. The GI Bill. And I figured, like so many do, 4 years, get that GI Bill and then carry on with life. of course, 14 years later, I'm still loving the military, and or at least, you know, at 14 years, I was still loving it and wanted to, you know, I decided by then that it was definitely going to be a career for me.
So you started off in the Navy, is that right?
I started in the Navy as a, what they called at the time, a mess management specialist, a cook.
Yeah.
Although they changed the name to culinary specialist, maybe because mess management specialist was just a mouthful. and what they didn't tell me at the recruiter station was that, because I'd been cooking my entire life. You know, from the time I could reach over the counter, I was making lunches for my brother, sister, and myself each day for school. And I loved cooking. It was a passion and a hobby. So I decided my first course of direction was in my career field was going to be in the culinary arts. I was going to be a chef. So I decided I wanted the Navy to teach me, you know, I was going to be a cook in the Navy while I earned that GI Bill. But they don't tell you is at the time that mess management specialist, they look at that sort of like civilian, the civilian version of hotel restaurant management. And my first duty station, though it was shore duty in Naples, Italy, it was fantastic. I was working in the barracks. And not only that, I was the maintenance manager. They were running trouble call tickets between the front desk and the Italian local national public works guys. It was a far cry from cooking, but I made the best of it. And I started going around with these guys, escorting them into the barracks rooms and just pointing at stuff and saying, como se dice, como se dice, how do you say this? How do you say that? And eventually I found that I was conversational in Italian. And I, in the, my off time, I'd go out into the local economy, into Italy. I'd become an Italian. I'd immerse myself in the local culture, cuisine, customs. It was fantastic. I'd go travel around Europe. And then my second 2 years, I went from the shore duty, PCS, only 45 minutes away, to the commander of the 6th Fleet in Gaeta, Italy. And I was then cooking for a 3-star admiral and his staff. And that was fantastic, especially because when the ship was in port, nobody wanted to stay after close of business, so I never had to make dinner. And I would show up nice and early, make breakfast, make lunch, hang up my uniform, and by 2 in the afternoon, I was an Italian. I was going to go, I immersed myself some more, and it was fantastic. It was an experience of a lifetime. With the ship, just sailing around the Mediterranean, I got to visit Greece, Slovenia, Croatia, Portugal, Spain, Malta, France, so many other places. On my leave and liberty time, I would travel around Italy, take an MWR trip to Germany or France. And it was amazing. It was an education of a lifetime as well. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So how long were you cooking for the Admiral?
I cooked for the Admiral for 2 years, and it was a change of command in between there. So I cooked for 2 Admirals. And it was a fun experience. The one overarching rule in his mess was we weren't allowed to cook Italian food. You have to be accomplished cook in the Navy to be a pretty decent chef to get to that level into the command galleys. Culinary specialists in the Navy are the ones who cook at the White House, Camp David, those places. And the commander of the C-6F is one of the launch pads, one of the for those positions. And he said, even though we cook pretty decent Italian food, he said, why would I want Italian food from you guys? We live here.
Right.
So the funny thing was, though, he's also, both of the admirals I cooked for were burger and fries guys. So we tried to dress them up as best we could, but they were happy with the, you know, some of the good old boy stuff, and you know, meat and potatoes was often on the menu.
That's awesome. So what are they on, an aircraft carrier or like a battleship, or where do the admirals stay when you guys are out on the sea?
When we were in port, he had a villa up in the Gaetano Hills. And the admiral did have a house attendant, a culinary specialist that worked right at the villa, and often he would have receptions there, in which we would go up and throw a party with him. And there, the top of the chain of command is Mrs. Admiral. But it was a fun experience, because he would often invite we both at his villa, and when the ship went out to sea and pulled into foreign ports, because the flagship doesn't do those 6 month cruises like the carrier groups.
Oh, okay.
They'll do maybe a 3 or 4 week cruise around the Mediterranean, pull into 2 or 3 foreign ports, run up the flag, and throw a reception on the flight deck. So, you know, we would be where we normally be cooking for, you know, 25 or 30, or sometimes 85 if we were going into one of those tax-free zones, and, you know, you get a couple TDY officers jumping on board to do some kind of training. I
don't know. Yeah.
But, yeah, all of a sudden our numbers in the galley doubled. But yeah, then we would do these receptions, and all of a sudden we're you know, doing, you know, party food for 300 or so. But it was a great experience. It was a lot of fun, and we'd always have an opportunity to get off the ship and experience the local cuisine, food, history. Loved it.
Well, that sounds like an awesome time. What was the what's your favorite country that you visited?
Well, you know, that's a hard thing to say. I because I was so immersed in Italy, that probably tops the list. But that's because I know the most about it in Europe. Every time I think of each place we've visited, I think, man, I need to get back there and learn more and do more and see it again and share it with my wife, who's her first trip to Europe was our honeymoon. And of course we went to Florence.
Yeah.
But it was great. It was great. We get to Florence, and I'm so excited to be back in Italy. Now, it, at that time, 2017, it was 12 years since I'd been there, since I'd been stationed there. And I just wanted to show off what I knew about Italy. I wanted to speak Italian, and I wanted to, you know, really, you know, show off what I knew. So every time we came across a taxi driver, the server at a restaurant, the hotel check-in, I would start speaking in Italian. And of course, you, whether they were impressed or not, they would respond in Italian to me. And I'd just go, no, I'm sorry. I'm deaf. You're going to have to talk to my wife. And then the Italian would speak Italian to her. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. She can't speak Italian. Tell her in English. She'll tell me, and then I can talk to you in Italian. And I know, there's silence, of course, when I can feel them both just staring at me like, is this guy an idiot? But I would still try it with everybody. And some of them humored me. And most of the time, I just kind of gave up and let my wife talk to, you know, every Italian over there, for the most part, speaks English far better than I speak Italian. But it was a great experience nonetheless.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I was in Italy for like 3 hours one time. I got off the airplane and went straight into the terminal, but it looked awesome from what I could see. We didn't get to enjoy any of it, but it looked like a place I would love to go back someday.
Yeah, that's pretty much my experience with the 4 or 5 times I've been to Ireland. You know, hitting the Shannon Airport, getting your couple pints of Guinness from that kiosk, and then back on the plane.
But I've heard the Guinness is far superior when you're in Ireland than if you're drinking in America. Is that true?
Did you know that the alcohol, it's Guinness is taxed, and beer and alcohol is taxed by alcohol volume. So it's got a lower alcohol by volume percentage domestically than it does for export, because they don't want to pay as much for the sales in country.
That makes sense. So
whether it's better or worse, I don't know, as long as it's cold.
Yeah, I like a good Guinness every now and then. So 14 years in the Navy, and at some point you decided to join the Army, is that right?
Not quite. I spent 8 years in the Navy, and now I was in Italy till about 2004. By that time, both wars were kicking off. In fact, I got to see some of those missiles take off from the Aegis cruisers, and then went over and turned on CNN and saw them land in Baghdad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I felt this, it was 4 years in the Navy by then, and I realized that, you know, I love serving my country. I love being a sailor. But I wanted to do something a little more direct than being the Admiral's cook. While it was a great experience, and most of the terrific times were when I hung up the uniform. But I don't discount the times I was in uniform. I wanted to do something more.
Yeah.
So when I got back to the States, I was stationed in Newport, Rhode Island. I volunteered for what they called individual augmentee, which is a volunteer piecemeal team. They're comprised of Navy and Air Force service members for Army positions for the Afghan PRTs around the country. Mm-hmm. So the Provincial Reconstruction Teams, I volunteered to run a PRT chow hall. So I went from cooking for the Admiral and his staff to cooking for 500 and 600 ISAF soldiers. It just so happened, though, we were in Farah, not far from Herat, and Herat is the main base for the Italian forces. So we actually had 3 platoons of Italian special forces, basically their version of the SEALs, on our base. And I went from Italy all the way to Afghanistan, and I still got to speak Italian. And I got to steal, I traded MREs for their espresso. So I was happy. No, yeah, but then, awesome. Well, yeah, it was excellent. It was a great experience. It was two, myself and one other Navy cook, and then 9 local national Afghans running this big chow hall, which is an experience all of itself. While I was there, I met some EOD technicians. I'd never known anything about it. And they were doing some PMCS on, just maintenance checks on their equipment. So they had robots and bomb suits and all their equipment laid out, and they were just checking batteries and whatnot. And I started talking to them, learning about what they do. And man, I was instantly hooked. I loved everything about it. The technical aspect of the job, the fact that they're saving lives, the close-knit brotherhood they've got once you become an EOD technician, and you get to blow things up. So there's no downside except for the fact that you're close to things that blow up.
Yeah.
So at that time in the Navy, the MOS, or the rates mine was CS, and it's EOD was not a rate itself. It was a qualification, and they took source rates. So master at arms, boatswain's mates, electricians, that kind of stuff. The culinary specialist was not a source rate. So they said, you can't do it. Plus, I was E5 at the time. That was undermanned. E6 was overmanned. So I wasn't getting promoted. They were going to let me strike out or, you know, shift to another rate. I was kind of stuck. So my contract was nearing its end, and I had to decide whether I was going to re-enlist or not. I finished my time in Afghanistan, came back to the States, and I let my contract expire. Went over to the Army recruiter, handed my paperwork over, and they said, "You want to go EOD?" Okay. And then, you know, 6 more years of Army life, I learned that I love being a soldier as much as I love being a sailor. The only difference there, though, is that I kind of became an EOD tech almost over becoming a soldier. They sent me through, at the time they had it was more like a gentleman's course for basic, because I was already, I kept my rank. So I went from petty officer second class to sergeant. And they were going to put a sergeant through basic training. So they had this, it was kind of on a trial basis. They had this cut down version of basic training where you learn all the same stuff, less of the yelling. Then I went on to the EOD training, and it's right here where we live at Eglin Air Force Base. I live just down the road from it. And it's a Navy run school on an Air Force base, but it's a joint school where all of the techs go for all the branches. So we all speak the same language. You know, every branch has their own version of hoorah, hooyah, but it doesn't mean anything. And they all have their own different jargon. You ask anybody what secure means. That's what's great about EOD is that we are a brotherhood across all the branches. I can get paired up with a Marine, Air Force, or a Navy EOD tech, and we can solve the same problems together. And it often happens. So I graduated from EOD school. I got stationed at Fort Drum, and within, you know, months, I was already in Iraq. I was a fresh EOD tech, but a sergeant, so I was placed kind of as a in the Army, the EOD runs normally as a three-person team, and I was a fourth man on the team. So what they did was send me to Task Force Paladin, and that was the Task Force Troy was in Iraq, and that was the sexy cell or counter explosive exploitation cell. Basically where all the evidence gets collected after it comes off the battlefield. It gets triaged to chemical, biological, electrical analysis. And I got to see where this evidence went and how to process it. And it made me such a better tech. And when I came back from Iraq, I was given a team. I became a team leader. And soon enough, I was in Afghanistan running my own team. And that's, you know, spent 8 months doing that, and mostly dismounted patrols throughout the Zarate district of Kandahar province. It was a really busy time, but the experience I got in Iraq was invaluable. And about 8 months into that is when, I got injured. I'd just come off of a 2-week R&R. I got to go home and visit the family. Got to see my son turn one. Got to spend time with family. Had Thanksgiving together. And then I was back in the field. And just threw the luggage into the back of our armored truck, and the team was driving me back out to our base. when the convoy commander called back and said, EOD, we've got something on the side of the road. It was an RAO. We were just driving through, but the QRF would have been, you know, a quick reaction force wasn't going to be as quick as us who were right there on the scene. So no time like the present. We kicked the robot out and it did its job. It found a pressure plate IED with a jug of homemade explosive, like 99% of the stuff we were finding there. But even though it could separate the components and it took the pressure plate away, the trigger, there was still the jug that was jammed into this hard packed dirt and the robot couldn't get it out. I wanted to get as much evidence as I safely could. So I jumped out of the truck and I started approaching with my metal detector, and about 20 to 30 meters from the primary device, there was a secondary device that hadn't been detected. About the same time my mine sweeper found it, my foot found it. And for some reason, I don't know what, the blast only hit me in the head. And I get the mule kick from hell. Yeah. Got punted into the air, landed on my knees and elbows, but I stayed alert. I was still awake. And I knew I'd just gotten blown up. So the first thing to do, I went into immediate, crisis mode. System check was first. I wiggled toes and fingers, moved elbows and knees, and realized I was still more or less intact. So I went upright on my knees, and it was nighttime, but the lights had gone completely out. And our truck has so many floodlights, it turns night into day. And for some reason, it was pitch black. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is bad. So I thought at first my helmet had gotten pushed over my face, and that's why. So I reached up and found that my helmet had gotten blasted completely off my head. And that's when I thought, oh no, the Army is going to want that back.
That was the first thing through your head at that time. This Army's going to make you pay for your own helmet.
No kidding. They came after me for it. I wasn't wrong. And it's funny how that was the first thought that went through my mind. Not quite ironic that they were like, did you find your helmet? I was on a medevac chopper. The reaction, we weren't far from CAF, so medevac was like 14 minutes. Went to Landstuhl, and within 48 hours, I was a Walter Reed. And reality was finally sitting in that I was never going to see again. The blast had taken my right eye completely. A piece of frag had cut across the orbital bone and across the bridge of my nose, and then put a gash bad enough in my left eye that it couldn't be repaired. I had cracks in my skull so bad that I was leaking spinal fluid right out my nostrils. Of course, my eardrums were blown out and face was kind of torn up and scarred and burnt. But there was virtually no damage below my neck. It's fantastic. Yeah. I'm extremely lucky. I was in there in the Walter Reed trying to figure out who was I now. I'd finally found this calling after kind of a strange career path. But I loved what I was doing. And now that was taken away from me. My eyesight was taken from me, and I was feeling pretty low. But I don't know if it's just, you know, my upbringing, the values that my family have instilled in me, the support I got while I was there. or the combination of that, plus the military teaching me resilience, teaching a sense of duty, no matter what, kind of the lace up and go, no matter what your situation is. Just the ethic behind it. And I wasn't going to let the demons in. I wasn't going to feel sorry for myself. I began, I went to the VA's blind rehabilitation school, where I learned how to use my cane and my talking computers and phone and all the accessible devices they've got out there. And I set out to become the best, fill in the blank, I could be, and just had to do it blind. Now I was going to be a great father. It's going to be a great son. I was going to be the best example I could to my fellow wounded veterans, to all my fellow veterans. And I began speaking, speaking around the country. And I also found that there are other wounded veterans, other blind people that have done some amazing things. There was a blind man who, Eric Weinmayer, who not a service member, not a veteran, but he's a blind person who's the only blind person who have ever climbed Mount Everest.
Oh, wow.
And if he can do that, I can stay off that couch and keep away from the pills, and I can avoid being one of the 22 we lose each day. And that's what I set out to do. In fact, I met, I connected with Eric. We went on a mountain climb together. I found out there's a blind veteran, Lonnie Bedwell, who was the first blind person to kayak the entire Grand Canyon in a solo kayak.
Wow.
So guess what? I kayaked with him, and I've done some whitewater with him. And just as kind of a byproduct of these adventures, I had to get, stay in shape. So I started running. And another blind soldier, Ivan Castro, he's a big time runner. And he said, I like to at least run at the Air Force Marathon, the Army 10 Miler, and the Marine Corps Marathon every year. I said, okay, I'm going to do that too. So before I'd run my first marathon, I'd signed up for those three. And somehow I got talked into two more marathons. I was signed up for a 10-miler and four marathons in 4 months.
Jesus.
And I hadn't yet run one. But that setting those lofty goals gives you something to shoot for. And three of those marathons qualified me for Boston. So you set outrageous goals, and then you get after it. And while you're working on your goals, you don't have time to worry or complain or feel sorry for yourself. I was well on my way to mastering this blindness thing when, about 4 years later, the injury kind of crept up on me again. The cracks in my skull, though the doctors had patched it, somehow it either reopened or weren't completely fixed. And I had, basically, it was an open passageway from my sinuses into my brain. And I contracted bacterial meningitis.
Man.
So, I was right back in the hospital. It was horrible. The bacteria felt like it was just eating my brain, like somebody poured acid into the. It was excruciating, and for weeks, the first few days, it began. Whether it was the bacteria or the heavy doses of antibiotics, I don't know, but it took what was left of my hearing and even stole the inner ear balance, the vestibular balance. So I got back home and I was completely blind, completely deaf. and I couldn't get around without a wheelchair at first. It was devastating. I was completely isolated. The whole world ended at my fingertips. And again, those I call those demons try to get in, the why me's, the what ifs, when have I paid my dues? When has this one soldier had enough? My girlfriend at the time, who I later had to make my wife, wouldn't let me feel sorry for myself for long. The only problem was all of those tools, those technologies for being blind, were basically almost all audio based, talking computers and phones. And Michaela, my wife, she had to write every letter of every word into the palm of my hand just to communicate with me. Imagine how tedious and frustrating that could be. My dad tried doing it, and he's a little dyslexic, so that was confusing for both of us. My mom, she tried doing it, and she's got this fancy script thing she does. I'm thinking that looks like a flock of seagulls in my palm. Michaela really was the only one that could communicate with me. And I did everything I could to not feel sorry for myself, get busy doing something. So I took the trekking poles I used for climbing in the mountains, and I held myself up almost purely by arm strength to walk again. And it was exhausting just getting down to the mailbox and back. But eventually I was walking with some assistance. Then I got on my treadmill, which always felt like, home to me, being now a marathon runner, felt as though I was trying to throw myself right off the treadmill, like somebody was trying to rip the treadmill out from under me. But I started, you press start, the quick start, and you get half a mile an hour. And I just started walking with this iron grip on the stability bars. And eventually I started jogging. And then I was stable enough that I could use one hand. And in the meantime, I was getting surgery to get the cochlear implant so I could possibly hear again. The only problem was I had to wait till the bacteria had cleared, the infection was gone, so a few months. And then they went with the most damaged ear, because the blast kind of came from my right side. My right ear has always been worse. So they went with that one first. And what we found out was no matter how high the output, how much power output they put on this implant, I wasn't going to be able to hear through that one. So they used it. They went and did the surgery for the left ear, and besides the surgery, you got to wait for the surgical site to heal. Then you go in and get the processor tuned in, and then it's not like snap, you can hear again. It's a whole different way. It's like a digital form when you're used to analog. It really is. It sends electrical signals past your inner workings of your ear to the cochlea in the inner ear, and right to the auditory nerve. And your brain doesn't know what to make of it at first. So it's really like listening to everything through a speak and say. And it's so difficult even now, but it is far better than the alternative. Because now I can be here speaking with you. So
that's awesome. I know when you first told me that you wanted to come on my show and that you were blind and deaf, I was like, okay, I want to talk to you so badly, but I don't know how this is going to happen. So yeah, when I was able to call you on the phone, and then you kind of explained a little bit how, cochlear implants work, and you can Bluetooth it to your computer and some of those kind of things. So I was like, okay, that makes sense.
That's great. Yeah, it's absolutely true. The technology today is amazing. And the most recent update to this cochlear implant is the Bluetooth technology. So I'm literally talking to you the audio, the input is going through the headphone jack into a mini microphone. It's a Bluetooth microphone, which is sending the Bluetooth signal to my processor. So I'm basically, you're talking straight into my brain because my ears are turned off.
Huh. That's crazy to me. I mean, medical technology is, it's just phenomenal what they're able to do these days.
Really is.
So, okay. Yeah. Your military service. And now you do your own business, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Which is, it's kind of a cool story all on its own. But as I was trying to find a way to cope with the hearing and the sight loss, the holidays were quickly approaching, and I kind of fell back on my earlier passion of cooking. I'd always been sort of a zen for me, a meditative state when I was cooking, and it was calming, it was relaxing, and it was very much a therapy for me. So Thanksgiving was coming, the holidays were on their way, and my family and some friends were invited. We were going to have a feast, and I set out, I was going to have the best feast ever. We had a turkey for the smoker, one for the oven, and a ham, all of the trimmings. I made two different types of stuffing, and I started making desserts way in advance, you know, weeks in advance. I was making cookies and cakes, and of course I was making this fudge, and I would as soon as I finished one batch of fudge, I'd be started on the next. I think I can try this flavor. Let's go with this different type of chocolate. How about some nuts or some spices? I was even dumping stuff from my bar in, you know, some alcohol in there. And this is going to taste great. And my wife said she noticed something she hadn't seen on me in 6 months. And that was a smile on my face. I was enjoying myself. I wasn't worrying. It was the same thing. I was doing something. And while you're busy towards a goal, you're not focused on being sorry for yourself. And I was actually happy. The only problem was I was making so much fudge that no one family could eat it all in one sitting. So my Caleb was sneaking it out the front door. I say sneaking like you've got to be real stealthy around a blind deaf guy. she was taking it and giving it to friends, family, or friends and neighbors. And a few of them started coming back and saying, hey, that was really good. Can we buy more of that from you? The capitalist in me said, well, of course you may.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we were in business. And we started cooking this fudge, and I almost overnight had something like 50 different flavors of fudge. I'm like, we can do it like this, like that. Michaela, who is the more the business savvy side, said, let's pare it down. Let's find our top six or so, and we'll start a website. And we started a business out of the house, but eventually the demand grew. We had to find a commercial kitchen, and we did so. We found a commercial food manufacturer that will make all of our recipes for us. And now the home is a R&D lab.
Yeah.
And I like to get my son, who's 8, into the kitchen with me, and we like to just create all sorts of fun stuff.
That's awesome. Is your son, is he one of the twins?
No. He's from a previous marriage.
Okay.
And you know, it was kind of funny. There was a bit of a custody battle there. But I won custody of my son, and when he came to me, he had only been eating, you know, junk food and not eating very well. And he was very standoffish of anything new. And I have such a spirit for adventure, especially when it comes to trying new foods, that it was kind of frustrating. So I said he wouldn't try different, like he wouldn't try nuts, he wouldn't try raisins. It was the most interesting thing. So one day I asked him if he wanted to make a chocolate bar, and he said, yeah. So well, I got out all these different little sample bowls of different types of nuts, cherries, you know, dried cherries, dried strawberries, dried, you know, the raisins, all sorts of different things. And I pulled out these, you know, big bags of chocolate that we had. And I said, which kind of chocolate do you want to start with? Dark, milk, or white chocolate? He grabbed a couple morsels of milk chocolate. And I said, hold your palm out. And I put two or three morsels in there, and I put a cashew in his hand. I said, pop that whole thing in your mouth and try it. And he chewed it up. He says, I like it. Of course you do. And then I said, let's try it with a pistachio. And he popped it in his mouth, and he said, I like it. And we went through that. And of course, every single thing he liked, as long as it had chocolate in it, he loved it. And eventually we were making these candy bars, and he liked the cashew bars. And as he's making his, I'm making one of dark chocolate and chili powder, or, you know, like ancho chili powder and pecans. And I said, you know, this is kind of fun. It's like discovering all sorts of new things. It's like being a detective and finding out your favorite flavors. You could put all sorts of crazy stuff in here. What do you think? We could even put chili powder. And he goes, oh, no, that'd be terrible. That'd be awful. I say, yeah, you're probably right. Here, try this. He goes, I like it. Of course you do. And that's how, you know, I cheated by using chocolate. But now he and I like to experiment with all sorts of different things, not just candy, but all sorts of different foods. And he's wide open to trying stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun too.
Yeah, it's kind of like ketchup with my daughter. If you put ketchup on it, she might try it, but more often than not, she just sticks her finger in the ketchup. And
ketchup. Yeah, I'll never cure my son of ketchup.
Yeah. That and ranch dressing. If you want him to eat some vegetables, just put some ranch dressing on there, and that gets the job done.
Usually, that's the trade-off.
Yeah, the carrots and the celery, you know, they just become the vessel just to get the ranch in your mouth, and they don't actually eat the vegetables half the time, but... You know, you got to do what you got to do to get them to try new things.
What was that? Sorry.
Oh, I said, yeah, you got to do whatever you got to do to get them to try new things.
Oh, yeah. In fact, now when you talk about the vegetables, I've got my son now asking me if I can make more hummus.
Yeah?
Yeah, he loves it. So now that's the favorite dip in the house.
Yep.
Instead of you know, like the sugary, you know, store-bought stuff.
Yeah, I make hummus every weekend. My daughter calls it a fancy dip. So she has no idea what it is. She just likes it. You know, I take a couple of cans of chickpeas that I buy from Aldi's, and I blend them up with some olive oil and usually like some salt, pepper, and some curry. And then pour that out, and she'll eat that whole little thing of hummus all by herself, and she loves
it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was. I was really surprised that worked out as well as it did.
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff with chickpeas. We buy big bags of the dry beans, and I'll soak them overnight, and we'll make stuff like falafel waffles.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot easier than throwing falafel balls in hot oil, which terrifies me. So I just turn the waffle maker on and put the falafel, mix in there, and it works out great.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting to try. So do you sell your fudge online on your website?
That's right. We sell not just the fudge, but a larger variety of stuff at eodfudge.com. And we just added our first non-edible thing. We have a t-shirt with our logo and my favorite saying, challenge accepted. Now available on there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you do motivational speeches too. Do you go in front of like corporations or anything like that? Or what's your normal avenue, I guess, for speeches?
I'll speak before just about any group. I've been hired by organizations such as Boeing, Intercontinental Hotel Group, and many others. I also speak to active duty and veterans, and I even volunteer at the local schools here. So anywhere I'm invited, I'm glad to share my story, and it's catharsis. It's cathartic for me to share it and to really own my struggles. But it's also great. It's a wonderful feeling for me to be able to share, maybe motivate and inspire others, and show some that are feeling a little bit down about their situation that no matter how tough it gets, it only can make you stronger.
Yeah. So I usually end the show by asking, you know, if you had one piece of advice to give somebody who's maybe having a hard time, what would you say?
I would say that it's the struggle that makes us strong. Avoiding hardships will only make us less resilient. We are getting stronger every day. And they talk about resilience kind of like a rubber band, snapping back, coming back after a stress, some struggle in your life. But humans aren't rubber bands. Each time we feel stress, every time we go through a hardship, a struggle, we get stronger. You know, you're working out in the gym, weights strengthen the body, and our struggles, our hardships strengthen our mind and our soul.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome advice. You're the most inspirational person I've ever talked to with your story, and I want to thank you for sharing it with me. I know it's probably not always the easiest to talk about, but I know that anybody who hears your story is going to walk away better for having heard it.
Well, thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate the kind words. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been a pleasure for me too.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Let's talk again sometime.
Yeah, will do.
Thanks for listening to the show. Be sure to check out the new website at www.AmericanHeritagePodcast.com. There you can find blog articles that I write, and also there's a tab for merchandise. There you can find new shirts that I have. I have one on right now. It's called the Max Effort, and it features an F-105 Thunder Chief dodging an SA-2 North Vietnamese anti-aircraft missile over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This shirt was inspired by a conversation I had with Wild Bill in one of the earlier episodes. Be sure to check out that episode and head to the website to pick up your shirt today. Thanks for listening to the American Heritage Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. Also, if you wouldn't mind, please consider being a donor. You can click on the support tab at the bottom of the show notes of this episode and every other episode. If you do that, you'll help offset some of the costs that come along with podcasting. Also, I will give a percentage of the proceeds straight back to homeless veterans via the Passageways LTD organization. They help homeless veterans get off the streets once and for all. So consider being a donor today. Once again, thanks for listening.